the high desert in the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening, good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be in the world's prolific time zones. This show covers every single one of them, called Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell, and it's an honor to be here with you for the weekend and giving you a little preview of what's ahead in the weekend. Tonight, Russell Targ, a remote viewer, in fact, also a physicist, and it's going to be a lot of, we're going to have a lot of fun with that. And also, open lines this hour, and more importantly, open lines all night tomorrow night. We're just going to throw it open and see what happens. Somebody sent me this again. I had read this a couple of weeks ago, and it does seem to fit oh so well. Life is not a journey to the grave with the intention of arriving safely in a pretty and well-preserved body, but rather a skid. It's a skid in broadside, thoroughly used up, totally worn out, loudly proclaiming, "Wow, what a ride!" I love that. I really do. All right, on the webcam earlier, just prior to airtime, I noticed they started putting my webcam up in the afternoon, so I had a couple of, I had a really cute cat photograph up there. But now, just moments before I came on the air, I trudged out to the end. You know, I've been telling you about this antenna structure of mine for weeks on end, probably, right? So I trudged out to the end of the antenna. It's about 5 acres in total. And I took a photograph. Those white steel poles or towers that you see there are 75 feet tall each. And that's on my webcam right now. It's one of the better photographs I've ever been able to take of it on the ground or from the ground. We still haven't taken that helicopter ride, which is coming up when we're going to measure some of the effects of this monster. But I thought this would give you a pretty good idea of what it looked like from the ground. It's really one of the better ground shots. So that's on my webcam right now. When you go to the coasttocoastam.com website, you'll notice Art's webcam listed on the left there. Just click on that. Now, the next item before we plunge into the news of the day. Earlier today, a ham friend of mine, an amateur radio friend, sent me a link to truly one of the most incredible things I've ever seen. And I hope that we don't blow up her website, but there's a young Russian gal named Elena who is a motorcyclist. My, what a motorcycle she has. Her dad worked in, you know, I guess on the Chernobyl, you know, the whole thing, the whole power plant. And this incredible woman, some of you may have seen this, takes high-speed rides and occasionally stops in the dead zone surrounding Chernobyl. And I think every human being on the planet, every single one of you should be looking at this. It's a series of perhaps as many as 30 or 40, I might add, high-resolution photographs of Chernobyl and the towns surrounding Chernobyl. And, you know, it will be 900 years, as you will read, before human beings can inhabit even the outskirts of that area, and maybe 58,000 years before it ever gets back to normal. 58,000 years! Or was it 85? I don't know. Way more years than any of us have. This you must go and see. So please do. I'd actually like to have your comments on it. And, you know, we're going to have open lines tomorrow night. And as I looked at this, it's poignant. It may bring tears to your eyes. I thought, well, you know, this happened to the Russians, to the communists. And it was so horrific, so horrible, that for those Russians that saw it, it may well have had at least something to do with the change in national attitude about everything nuclear. I mean, it's that strong. It's that compelling. So if you go to the coasttocoastam.com website, right there, you know, boldly in the front is the link that I sent thanks to my friends, to Lex Lonehood, and he put it up for me. Let's hope we don't crash her site, and if we do, try it in a couple of days. It's called Riding Through Chernobyl. You've never seen anything like it in your whole life, I guarantee it. So cruise on up there, and let's test her, see how broadband she is. I'd love to get her on the program. We're hoping to get some sort of connection. Her English is broken, but, you know, as you read through the captions on the photographs, it sort of adds to the surreal feel of the whole thing as you take this chilling, mind-boggling tour. In a moment, we'll dip into the real news of the world. Well, the Riding Through Chernobyl website appears to have crashed. That took about 3 minutes. Be patient and continue to try the link as time progresses. This is worth doing. And Lex, if you're listening, just leave it up, if you would, please. Hopefully her website will recover. All right, looking around the world right now, rebel rockets slammed into a government building in the northern city of Mosul on Saturday, killing 2 civilians, wounding 14 others. An explosion rocked central Baghdad in a roadside bomb attack on a convoy, wounding 5 Iraqis. The Mosul attack brought to 21 the number of people killed in 2 days of explosions and shootings across Iraq. And I wonder out loud now how we're going to get out of Iraq, whether we ever will get out of Iraq, and whether we're just going to be a standing target. It works both ways, and I'm trying to think this through, what's happened in Iraq. I was not exactly for the entire war, as you know, prior to its occurrence, but it's happened now. And so, a really good question is, what do we do now? We're there and we're sitting targets on the one hand. On the other hand, so are the terrorists. Every terrorist organization able to get anybody into Iraq to try and kill Americans or cooperating Iraqis is doing that. And so they're sitting targets. So in a way, we've got a place where we can get them. But of course, they are getting us. So I don't know. What's the exit strategy? Was there ever one? I believe our president said we will not remain a day longer than necessary, and I'm wondering how long it will be necessary. John Kerry said Saturday the White House is committing character assassination with its treatment of former counterterror chief Richard Clark in order to avoid responding to questions about national security. Kerry also said that Condoleezza Rice, President Bush's national security advisor, ought to testify in public before that commission investigating the September 11th terror attacks. All kinds of things right now running around the internet about people who reportedly had foreknowledge about what was going to happen September 11th. I guess the hearings will find out, maybe. NASA has apparently set a record by this plane it sent up earlier Saturday. This plane that for 11 seconds accelerated within the atmosphere to 5,000 miles per hour before plunging into the Pacific about 400 miles off the California coast. 5,000 miles an hour. I wonder where we got the technology that allowed that. Ever wonder who would represent Saddam Hussein in a trial? Well, it's going to be a French lawyer. Not a great surprise there. Known for defending terrorists, and in fact a Nazi leader at that. This French lawyer said Saturday he will defend Saddam Hussein. Apparently got a plea from Saddam's family that he be defended, and so this French lawyer will take it on the job. I just caught this before airtime, and it's pretty interesting. New Orleans, it's a groundbreaking court decision that legal experts say will affect everyone. Police officers in Louisiana, it seems, no longer need a search warrant or an arrest warrant to conduct a brief search of your home or your business. Leaders in law enforcement say, why, it'll provide safety to officers, but others argue it's a privilege that could be abused. The decision was made by the New Orleans-based Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Two dissenting judges called it, quoting here, the road to hell, end quote. The ruling stems from a lawsuit filed in Denham Springs in 2000. New Orleans Police Department spokesman Captain Marlon DeFilo, I believe it is, said the new power is going to go into effect immediately and will not, he says, be abused. Well, here's one you ought to pay attention to. The first known hurricane to form in the South Atlantic, churned off the coast of Brazil. It's going to hit Brazil. Churned off the coast of Brazil as puzzled forecasters wondered just how the storm came to be and whether it might hit land. No hurricane has been spotted in the South Atlantic since satellites began tracking all of this back in the 1960s. It's never happened, folks. You see, hurricanes don't form there. Hurricanes form on or off the African continent and drift toward us in the west. But here it is. Winds of 74 to 95 miles an hour at 11:30 p.m. Eastern on Friday. The hurricane was centered around 345 miles east of the coast of Brazil. The storm moving southwest parallel to the coast, unclear whether it would strike land, because computer tracking models are simply not designed to handle storms that form in the South Atlantic, because that doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen. Forecasters are scratching their head trying to figure out, well, now, how could this storm have formed? The hurricane season in the North Atlantic runs from roughly June 1st through November 30th. So they don't know why the storm is there. They don't know why it formed. Not a clue. Why? Well, it's because we're in the middle of the change. Now, it has begun. Our climate change has begun. And this is but one more sign of that. So while I was surprised, I wasn't that surprised. Jan Berry, a member of the duo Jan and Dean, that had the 60s surf music, things like Dead Man's Curve, Little Old Lady from Pasadena, dead today at 62 years of age. He had a seizure and stopped breathing Friday at his home. He was pronounced dead that evening at a hospital. He had been in poor health, of course, from the lingering effects of brain damage that he had from a 1966 car crash. Also co-wrote the lyrics for Surf City, Dead Man's Curve. Remember him, Jan Berry, dead at 62. A strong signal of, this is really interesting, a strong signal of life on Mars has now been detected by scientists at the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, and the European Space Agency. Each group has independently discovered tantalizing evidence of, get this, folks, methane. In the Martian atmosphere, methane is a waste product of living organisms here on Earth. It could also be a byproduct of alien microbes living under the surface of the red planet. Where have we heard about life under the surface of the red planet? The detection of methane has been the holy grail of scientists studying the Martian atmosphere, as its presence could indeed provide unequivocal proof that there is life beyond Earth. That's one theory. Neither NASA nor the European Space Agency has publicly announced any of these findings yet, but specialists who have seen the data believe the discovery is genuine, although they are unsure of what it means in confirming the presence of life. And then this is worth considering. Scientists speculate, this comes from Whitley Strieber's Unknown Country. Scientists speculate that bacteria may spread through the universe on asteroids and that life on Earth, well, may have come from Mars. Now they've discovered quite the opposite, that life on Mars may have come from the Earth and during the last 30 years. In New Scientist, David L. Chandler quotes NASA's Andrew Schurgner saying, I quote, I believe there is life on Mars, and it's unequivocally there because we sent it. He says that of all the space probes sent to Mars, only the two Viking craft in 1976 were sterilized, a procedure which is routinely now done. He thinks some Earth bacteria may still be living on Mars. We now know that salt water existed for a very long time on the surface of Mars, and some life could survive there still. But could it be from Earth? They're probably not going to survive in 200 Kelvin conditions and in sulfuric acid, said Jeff Cargill of the U.S. Geological Survey. Maybe they could. And maybe we've just done a terrible thing. So, that's pretty interesting. In other words, they're suggesting that until the most recent rovers, which we sent every other spacecraft, they never bothered to sterilize before sending it. And the life that we find there may be ours. It's always going to confuse the issue, I suppose, eh? And now, we are about to go to open lines at the bottom of the hour, so be sure and when you hear the phone numbers play, they are a little different on the weekend, by the way. Make note of them. And tomorrow night, as I mentioned, open lines all night long. Oh, now look at what they've developed. And NASA, once again, right in the middle of it. NASA hears words not yet spoken is the headline. This is NASA. NASA has developed a computer program that comes close to reading thoughts which you have not yet spoken. How are they going to do that? Well, they do it by analyzing nerve commands to your throat. In other words, you need not actually speak the words. The words can be retrieved by a computer before they even reach your lips. Now, how many times do you, think about something upon meeting somebody, have a fleeting, fast thought? You know, we all have first reactions to people, or bosses, or friends, or, mates in life. Keep that damn machine away from me. Anyway, this machine would have application, of course, to perhaps help the handicapped, because their thoughts cannot be articulated as the rest of us would. So I guess all they would need to do is think of it and begin to mentally form the words, and out they come. Remarkable. They simply put sensors under the chin and then one on each side of your Adam's apple. And somehow they are able to cause, or your brain will then, of course, send commands to speech organs, but even before those commands are executed by the mouth, this machine would pick them up. So, now let's think about this. How many times in your life have you had something that you were about to say right on the very tip of your tongue, but you held it back, therefore saving yourself some terrible embarrassment or possible even further trouble? Heck, as a talk show host, it's happened to me a lot. Lordy, what if there was a machine like that hooked up to me and then modulated out to the air, and things that I was thinking as I was talking to a caller or a guest or simply doing a monologue came rolling out without my specific permission? Now they've got the technology. So how about it? You up for having a couple of electrodes hooked up to your Adam's apple? Maybe your chin? Imagine a world where thoughts came tumbling out. It's a little like remote viewing, only, I guess, a little more precise. Thoughts just came tumbling right out of a computer before you ever said them. Imagine that. Imagine a lot of things. That's what we're here to cause you to do in the nighttime. From the high desert, this...
Now it begins.
It sure does. It's Coast to Coast AM.
Sign up for Streamlink at www.coasttocoastam.com. And you can hear tonight's show over and over and over.
And watching the birds, now it begins, day after day. This is my life.
Be it sight, sound, smell or touch. Something inside that we need so much. The sight of a touch, or the scent of a sound, or the strength of an oak roots deep in the ground. The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. To have all these things in our memories haunt and to use them.
Take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
It is indeed. I just noticed that, you know, the scream when this song at the beginning comes to the crescendo, that incredible scream, it actually sounds like it was done, if I didn't know better, I said, hey, that was a Dean political scream. Next time you hear it, listen very well. Maybe I can bring it back up here. I'm not sure if I can, but I'm going to give it a try here. Let's see if we can bring it up underneath. And it's the crescendo. This, of course, Moody Blues. Now, listen very carefully when we get to the crescendo moment and see if that doesn't remind you, bring back to mind the Dean scream.
The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. To have all these things in our memories haunt. And to use them to help us to find.
There you have it. Tell me, was that it or what? Well, all right, then, as promised, here we go. First-time caller line, you are on the air. Good evening.
Hello, Art.
Hello, sir. Yes, that's you.
Okay, this is Orville. I'm calling from Miami, Florida. I listen to you on WIOD.
Yeah, oh, what the big monster there, yes.
Oh, yes, it is. I went on your website before the show started about 2 hours ago and saw the link to Elena's webpage and read all 27 chapters, and that is amazing.
It is.
I mean, she's got stuff in there that you do not see or did not see when this was in the news.
And if I might inquire, when you had finished the tour, what were your feelings, your emotions?
It was, well, a lot of them. The biggest one was that I didn't believe that it could have caused so much damage.
Yeah. You know, it hit me so hard that I wondered, I wondered if the communists, after experiencing that, and until, you know, we've had this kind of a tour available on the website, right? And we wouldn't know, and just as you didn't know, but they really experienced it, and to see that, it might change one's entire way of thinking. I don't care a communist or Republican or who and what you are. You've seen that.
Yes, I agree with you. It makes you wonder what the people, if the people at Three Mile Island saw that, what they would have done.
I don't know, but everybody should see it. Everybody.
Yes.
So, I hope the poor lady...
Well, it is back up now, because I just went in and looked at page one.
All right.
But
excellent.
Then I dropped back off, because I've already seen all 27 pages.
Oh, excellent news. All right.
And
well,
I did a good thing, I hope. I sent the webmaster I'm on the Eastern time zone, so about 4 o'clock this afternoon, I think it was. Maybe it was a little later. I sent the webmaster a note telling him to expect lots of hits tonight. And he replied saying thank you and asked me why, and then I told him.
Well, I hope some of you out there will write to Elena, and if you can find a way. And
yes.
I want her as a guest. I want to talk to her. You know, her broken English, in a way, it makes the whole thing more surreal as you read the way she has written everything.
Right. Well, I asked the webmaster, if somebody, or and I even sent it to the customer service at Angel Fire there, someone could convince her to post her email address.
Somebody at Angel Fire ought to hear this and grant her a little more bandwidth.
Right. Right. She deserves it.
All right. Thank you so very much. Yes. The whole thing, it will be one of the most chilling, thoughtful experiences you've ever had. This is something we did. And by we, I mean this is something that human beings did to themselves, communist or not. Doesn't matter, and it's going to make you very thoughtful about how and whether we should handle nuclear energy. And I'm not suggesting that it's not productive, but this site will not be suggestive, but will indeed show you what the dangers are, and they're beyond description. Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hi.
Art.
Yes.
Matt from Tampa.
Hey, buddy.
How you doing?
Good.
Okay, first off, on behalf of all the security guards working nights, thank you for keeping it interesting.
You're very welcome. It must be kind of a lonely, quiet, generally thankless job.
It is, but for the people that choose this line of work, it's great.
Yes.
You don't. In this business, you don't have to be a people person necessarily.
Well, as I once told another security guard on the air, you guys are on the front line of everything. I mean, in every horror show I've ever seen, the security guard, you know, I mean, the film starts out, there's a security guard walking around with a key, you know, doing his normal thing, and before you know it, he's shredded.
Yeah, the first Die Hard movie.
Absolutely. The
yeah, but anyway, what I want to talk to you about
yes.
is this hurricane off of Brazil.
Oh, yes.
Now, I've read Superstorm probably about half a dozen times.
Really?
Yeah, I love the book.
Uh-huh.
I think the reason it's there is the Gulf Stream has already indeed shut down.
Yes.
And all the warm water, it's stuck south of the equator.
Well, I'm not sure that it shut down, but all of these things that we're getting now, the extinctions, the changes in our weather patterns, hurricanes developing where they have not ever in our recorded history done so before. These are all indications of the change that's underway right now. Whether or not the Gulf Stream has stopped, I'd have no way of knowing. I sort of doubt it, but there is a change, a massive, profound change underway, and it's already begun. It's already started. So we'll see it unfold. Now, as you know, on May 28th, the movie, based in part on our book, is coming out nationally.
I can't wait.
I'm looking forward to it. It's called The Day After Tomorrow.
Yep.
Have a good night. Have a great night, sir, and take care. Yes, a hurricane developing where one ought not be. Well, that simply means that conditions that will breed hurricanes, conditions normally confined to somewhere off the coast of Africa, have to some degree shifted, and there are now conditions present in a place where they were not previously present over a great deal of ocean. Now, how could that have happened? Well, quite obviously, the change is underway. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning, actually, I guess, back there. Hi.
Morning, Art. How you doing?
Okay.
I'm calling from WLAP, Lexington, Kentucky.
All right.
My name's Ken. I've got a question. I went on the Internet the other night just out of curiosity and was looking up icebergs and was just seeing how long that they exist. And they, I guess, roughly a year, and they travel great distances. And I think Darwin said that sometimes the icebergs literally take rocks and soil and plants and travel them to another continent and deposit them.
Oh, yes, indeed. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in that theory, in that line of thought, I was going to ask you if you might know any cryptidology people who are trying to correlate icebergs with sea monster type sightings, deep sea, or even the lake monster, you know, like Champ and Ogopogo.
Ah, so your theory being that when the iceberg calves, the frozen, instantly frozen monster comes with it, and then, of course, he unfreezes.
Right, just like a frog in the wintertime. You know how they freeze up in a pond, and then come spring, they thaw out, and they're okay.
I'm not aware of any sightings that we could correlate with the calving icebergs, or even ones that have you know, been sailing along for a while, but it's an interesting theory, and one the previous caller, the security guard, might well bear in mind as he makes his rounds this evening. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
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 On the nuclear thing, before we get to my subject.
Yes.
I worked with nuclear weapons in the Air Force, took them apart, and it's, in my opinion, only a matter of time before one of those things goes off, you know, as a weapon.
Yeah, must have been an interesting job to have, assembling or disassembling nuclear devices.
Indeed. We targeted and lined them for, you know, on top of the missiles and carried them back and forth, you know, as children, 21 years old, 30 years ago.
Yes.
Yeah. 40 years ago. A long time ago.
Well, you've got to really get to this website if you have the opportunity.
I will. I will do that tomorrow.
Okay.
And I wanted to talk about the origin of life in mud puddles. One, you know, the theory holds that 5 billion years ago, 10 billion years ago, life started up in some mud puddle. And the question that I ask is, well, you know, if it could do it then and there, or if it did it in a thermal event somewhere, why doesn't it do it again? It's had 5 billion years to start up right here on Earth, a separate time, but according to, you know, the theory of evolution, we're all interrelated to this original life form. And it, but if the theory of evolution and origins were correct, you'd think in that intervening period.
That it would, yes, I get your drift. A lot of mornings I feel like I crawled out of a mud puddle. However, what he suggests is indeed an interesting thing to ponder. If a life formed in a mud puddle, or even for that matter, the ocean, then should we not be able to detect this continuing evolution, evolutionary process, which some would suggest is very common as lightning strikes these various bodies of water and so forth and so on? There should be new life emerging. Well, maybe there is, and we simply don't detect it in the riot of life that already exists here. I don't know, but it's an interesting thing to ponder. You're on the air, Coast to Coast AM. Where are you calling from, please?
Oh, hi, Art. Is it me?
Yes, it is.
Oh, I'm calling from the Big 550 in St. Louis.
KTRS.
KTRS.
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I wanted to ask a couple of questions. First of all, I understand the Bush administration had authorized licensing to nuclear plants for operation that were substandard and dangerous.
That I'm not aware of. However, one never knows. But, I thought that our, nuclear regulatory commission had rather stringent regulations, and I don't know.
I had heard something about that a couple of years ago, and also this phenomenon with the dolphins and the whales beaching themselves.
Yes.
What, down in Florida and on the East Coast?
Yes.
I read, I did a report, this was in college. There's some kind of testing, sonar testing going on outside of, off the coast of Puerto Rico, and they were suing the administration of the Navy.
Yeah, the Navy has been actually sued over this a number of times, also in some sonic testing they were doing off the coast of Hawaii. So this is not new. A lot of people have complained about the possible damage to marine mammals by, you know, with the testing they're doing.
Well, what kind of testing is it? What are they trying to do exactly?
Well, you know, I guess a lot of it is new sonar-related stuff in various ways to either, you know, find submarines and that sort of thing. It's ongoing. And I suppose, you know, their argument certainly would be that it's necessary for national security that we do this sort of thing, that we test these sorts of things out. And I understand the other side of it as well, the concern for the mammals. I was watching a very interesting... My God, I love the Discovery Channel. What a wonderful channel that is. I was watching a special on the Florida, on the state of Florida, up in the Panhandle. They've got these natural springs. And divers were going down to a depth of about 300 feet and then diving for miles and miles and miles under these caves of incredibly fresh water. Now, just one little worrisome thing, though, that seems to be driving them ever so harder now. There's no farming in the area that could contribute toxins, and yet they're now measuring these toxins at just unprecedented levels in the water, and they have no idea where they could come from. And so they're trying to trace these underground tunnels. Divers risking their lives, going 300 feet down and then through tunnels from which there would be no escape should your equipment in any way at all malfunction. And they're trying to figure out how these toxins, I mean, normally the water in these tunnels would take millions and millions or tens of millions of years to get down there in the first place. And it's clean, but it's got these toxins. Well, the mystery is, where are they coming from? And I suppose, what effect are they having? West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Yes, this is Steve. I'm in Hesperia, California.
Oh, yes, Steve. And you are obviously on a cell phone. Right?
Just getting home.
No, Steve. I said you're on a cell phone.
Yes, I said correct.
Yes, oh, okay.
And anyways, I was calling to tell you about a time when me, my wife, and my father were, I was living in Lucerne Valley. I'm sure you know where that is.
I do.
And we were up there. I lived up there pretty much the top of one of the roads that go up towards the mountainsides. This is the San Bernardino Mountains there.
Yes.
And we were sitting out there on the front porch in the middle of July, as a matter of fact. And come across a couple of orbs glowing in the sky.
Ah, orbs.
And they were really bright, and they looked far away.
What makes you call them orbs?
They were round, glowing, kind of like almost like a fireball, but not really like a fireball. It's just real bright.
Yes, sir.
Orange-colored.
And what,
I thought that was real interesting. I've been wanting to call you for years. I'm a long-time listener.
Thank you very much. Well, you have now, and it does bring up the subject of orbs. Now, I don't know, a few months ago or so, I was kind of, I think I was at the stage where I believed that these orb photographs were nothing more than lens reflections. I mean, they very much look like lens reflections. But then with a closer examination, while some of them surely are, many certainly are not lens reflections. And so an orb, I don't know. An orb could be anything in the world or out of this world. An orb could be a dimensional being represented by, that energy. An orb could be a human spirit, a soul. or, well, I just don't know. But what I do know is not all orbs are simple reflections of a lens, which at first glance, most people, I think, would think they are. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
This is Bob. I would like to know whether a Suez-type canal, a sea-level canal across the Isthmus of Panama, would attenuate the hurricanes in the South Atlantic. If, from memory, my charts on the currents that flow about that portion of the southern continent would provide a cooling mechanism for that continent itself.
Gosh, Bob, I don't know. And I, being honest with you, I have no idea if it would attenuate. I just have no idea, Bob.
It would provide a tremendous amount of labor for people in that part of the world and make them filthy rich with that top of a canal where the tankers and the aircraft carriers could go through it.
Well, I mean, we do have the Panama Canal. I mean,
but it's restricted on what can get through there, and at the same time, a plowshare program would only have to carry it down to where robots or nuclear submarines could constantly scavenge in the material out into the ocean.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the answer to that would be. In other words, if you actually build, of course, he's referring to the locks in the Panama Canal. If you were to actually build a cross land, an opportunity for the Atlantic to meet the Pacific and to join in at that point. I'm not saying it might not be a good idea, but it might not be a good idea. There's something about man tampering about with the natural course of things that seems to have, more times than not, unintended consequences. I love that phrase. Don't you? Unintended consequences. Man does a lot of things that result in unintended consequences. But on the other hand, Bob, maybe it's a really good idea. From the high desert, this is Coast to Coast AM.
Tonight's guest, log on to coasttocoastam.com. At area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from East of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From West of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
A journey to the center of the mind, indeed. Good morning. Russell Targ, is a physicist and an author. He was a pioneer in the development of the laser and laser applications. That's hardware, folks. Was co-founder of the previously secret Stanford Research Institute's investigation into psychic abilities in the 1970s and 80s. His work in this new area called remote viewing, very familiar certainly to the listeners of this program, was published in Nature. The Proceedings of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, IEEE, and the Proceedings of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Mr. Targ did graduate work in physics at Columbia University, is co-author of 6 books dealing with the scientific investigation of psychic abilities, so he should have many a story. In 1997, Targ retired from Lockheed Martin Missiles and Space Company as a senior staff scientist, where he developed airborne laser systems for the detection of wind shear. He now pursues ESP research in Palo Alto, California, and will be here in a moment. It should indeed be a journey to the center of the mind. Well, all right, ladies and gentlemen, meet Russell Targ. Russell, welcome back to the program.
Good evening. I'm very happy to be with you and hear your nice, smooth radio voice come through my telephone.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you here, and always necessary, even though this is a very mature audience, and many of them are certainly familiar with remote viewing and remote viewers, it's necessary always to at least provide a nugget of 101. What is remote viewing, why it was supported by, well, it says here NASA, I didn't know they had anything to do with it, CIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, and such, why it was supported, why it isn't supported now, and I guess first, what is it?
Well, remote viewing is an ability that we all have, the psychic ability that we all have to describe and experience what's happening in a distant place or even in a future time. What we discovered at the Stanford Research Institute program is that we could assist people to quiet their mind, stop their mental chatter, and come into contact with what is actually occurring at distant places. And we help people learn to quiet their mind so that they could provide useful information for all those interesting government agencies that you just enumerated. So we provided information for the CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency, NASA, Army Intelligence, and over a period of more than 20 years, almost every part of the intelligence community supported the work that we were doing at SRI.
Yes, well, those are very serious people, Russell, and other than an occasional hammer or toilet that they overspend on, they tend not to just, take off in directions like this and toss away money. And it went on, I understand, with the CIA for about 20 years. So there must have been something way back at the beginning when the program was originally conceived or justified that convinced some very powerful people that, oh, my God, these people are on to something. In other words, some powerful demonstration to get taxpayer money rolling on this kind of program. Well, how did that happen? Do you know?
Well, what you say is certainly correct. That is, in my work in lasers, for example, if we could get government support for 2 years, that was considered wonderful.
Absolutely.
But the idea that you can get government support for 23 years for a same ongoing program, that's a paranormal event all by itself.
It is. Well, so what was the original genesis? In other words, somewhere there was a meeting, and it was demonstrated to somebody of great power, or perhaps
the meeting was, Hal Puthoff and I were known as successful laser scientists. This would have never happened if Puthoff and I had just been psychologists walking in off the street. We'd have never gotten through the front door of the CIA.
Yes.
But by the time we appeared at the CIA, we had already done lots of complicated things for the federal government in the laser community. So we were able to escalate our way right up to the director of intelligence at the CIA. Who's
well, I can see how that got you in the door. And was, and you were saying the name again was?
It was John McMahon.
John McMahon.
A very courageous lawyer, intelligence operator, flown in the belly of C-130s. I worked for John McMahon as head of our program at the CIA, and then a decade later, he and I both left the program and both went to Lockheed.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he went to Lockheed as the president of Lockheed, and I went as an engineer, but our friendship continued. But when Hal Puthoff and I walked into John McMahon's office at the CIA, he was prepared to give us a very few minutes, and we told him, as scientists, we had found that people could describe what's going on in distant places. And we told them about experiments we had done with Ingo Swann, the famous New York psychic,
yes,
and Pat Price, who is a psychic police commissioner who worked with us. And we had been describing different places in the San Francisco Bay Area where someone would go and hide, and then Pat or Ingo would describe very, very accurately what it looked like there.
And you had documentation of this.
Absolutely. We had the greatest oversight that any program at Stanford ever had, where we showed pictures of what it looked like at the distant hiding place together with the description that the psychic gave us in the laboratory. McMahon said that if we're really doing that, then we're wasting our time describing swimming pools and churches in Palo Alto.
Yes.
He has places that really need a description.
Yes.
So 2 weeks later, he sent a CIA physicist to Stanford Research Institute,
uh-huh,
and that man gave us geographical coordinates, latitude and longitude,
uh-huh,
of a place that the CIA really wanted a description of.
I've never heard this, so this is how it happened.
This was a, McMahon said, we have national security interests. We would really like to know some of the activities in the Soviet Union.
Uh-huh.
So he sent us a CIA operative with geographical coordinates.
Mm-hmm.
So Pat Price, the police commissioner, and I went up to our little electrically shielded room. And Price, as he often would do, would polish his glasses and close his eyes and went on to describe his mental impressions that were triggered as I read off the geographical coordinates to him. We're sitting in this little metal-walled phone booth-like arrangement,
mm-hmm,
that all 6x6 cubicle covered with electrical shielding. Price closed his eyes and said that he is psychically lying on the top of a building, and he said the sunshine feels good on his body, but as he lies there in the sunshine, an enormous crane is rolling back and forth over him. He said this is the biggest crane he'd ever seen. This is all psychic perception. So this crane is so big it has wheels on one side of the building and wheels on the other side that he never saw anything like this. He wants to draw it. And he then made a drawing of what he called a gantry crane,
uh-huh,
a giant A-frame crane with 8 wheels running on tracks on either side of the building. And he made quite a good-looking 3-dimensional drawing of that.
All right, so this man was seeing this from the perspective of lying on the building, looking up at the crane with it literally rolling over him.
That's what he said. That was his experience.
Okay.
Now, the interesting aspect of remote viewing that makes it so useful is that once you've made contact with a target site, you have mobility at the target so that he could then pull back and describe what this thing looks like from various perspectives. So we went then, we climbed out of our little booth and went down to a secure safe because a CIA man had a satellite photograph. This is in the 70s where satellite photography was top secret.
Mm-hmm.
So we went into the secure facility at SRI and they unrolled this big drawing. And sure enough, in the middle of the drawing was a gantry crane, just like Price described.
Yeah, that'd do it.
So people were very shocked at this.
What do you know what, in fact, the target was? Is that...
Well, the target was this facility at Semipalatinsk in the Soviet Union.
Huh.
And they wanted to know what was going on there. So the thing that we were told is what they always say is, well,
you described very accurately what we already knew was there. You're looking at the right place. Can you tell me about what they're building inside that building, which nobody in the Western world knows?
Yes.
Now, of course, we could give a perfect description of that, and we would never get feedback. But we went back into our room, and Pat Price described that they were fabricating a big steel sphere, 60 feet in diameter, and they were trying to weld it together out of orange peel-shaped slices. They're trying to build this big 60-foot sphere, and he drew how they were trying to weld it together.
Yes.
Well, 2 years later, unfortunately, Price died, and the Russians finally rolled the big sphere out of the building where it was being constructed so that our satellite photography could verify that Price had exactly described what they were building. And it was concluded by the CIA that the Russians were building a particle beam weapon for the purpose of shooting down the satellites of America that were taking these pictures. And we then wound up before the House Committee on Intelligence Oversight because Congress was concerned that there was some kind of security leak because no one else in the Western world had this information.
That's astounding. That's astounding.
So they wanted to know, how did a bunch of crazy psychics in California have this information about a particle beam weapon and nobody else knew about it?
Understood. And so you, of
course... The result of that is that our friends from the Defense Intelligence Agency and the CIA came and said, no, indeed, there was no security leak. These people provided information to us over the past 2 years, and we got to stand just where our late great president Clinton stood in the well of the House of Representatives, and we were defending our program the way he was defending his presidency. But we prevailed, and they told us to press on, and we pressed on for another 20 years.
Well, I believe now, for the first time, the American people are hearing how it really began. That's a pretty darn impressive beginning.
So we provided what looked like a three-dimensional mechanical drawing picture of something that was going on in the Soviet Union that nobody else knew about.
That would do it.
And I should say that we describe how that all happened in my brand new book called Limitless Mind. We describe a lot of stories for the first time. This is the first book I've written by myself, so I don't have a well-behaved author, co-author, to hold me back. I talk about stuff we did with the FBI and the CIA and some of our war stories.
Do you think you went too far?
No, this has to be told now. See, you have good friends like Michio Kaku out there who says there is no ESP, it's all some kind of mistake. And on the other hand, we're providing information to the CIA and the DIA for two decades. One day it would be fun to be on your show with Professor Kaku and talk about the data.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I got an email from somebody who knew you were going to be on and writes, hello, Mr. Bell. I've been a long-time listener. It's really nice to hear your voice again on the weekends. George Norrie is doing an excellent job as well. Since you have a physicist, Russ Targ, on your show tonight, I thought perhaps you could get his views on the sudden interest by mainstream science on the whole cold fusion debate. Again, apparently the Department of Energy is going to review its original 1989 conclusions, and it may be real. Since you're a physicist, why? I wonder if you've heard anything about that at all.
Yes.
Oh, you have.
It's not actually cold fusion. It's a kind of ultrasonic experiment where they create tiny bubbles under very high pressure, and as these tiny bubbles explode under high pressure, it's as though you have a fusion-type reaction occurring that give off neutrons and radioactivity. So it looks more believable than the previous cold fusion that had been reported 10 years ago.
But still a relative of that, no doubt.
That's right.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's more reproducible than the initial cold fusion, which involved electrolysis of palladium.
Mm-hmm. Well, Russell, you know, I mentioned the first hour to you before you came on the air. You hadn't heard it because you were doing something else. But on our website, Coast to Coast AM, we've got this incredible thing. This gal, you may have seen this. Her name is Elena. She's a motorcycle rider, and she has ridden this motorcycle again and again right through the dead zone surrounding Chernobyl. And it's something that I want to come back to with you, the whole Chernobyl thing.
Well, I'm a motorcycle rider also, so I'll be happy to talk to you about
that. Oh, well, this you should take this tour. It's going to take you a little while, so perhaps now after the program. At any rate, back to the Kaku connection for a second. Somebody else says, I notice you've got Russell Tugon, who investigates remote viewing applications. I was wondering if, for example, a physicist like Dr. Kaku, well, suppose he also happened to be a remote viewer, would the physicist be able to use remote viewing to further scientific knowledge in the area of physics, your area? And what about other scientific disciplines? But keeping it to physics for a moment, Russell, would there be something that was some application for remote viewing and physics?
Well, I'm always happy to tell you when I don't know the answer to something.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly there are people like Nikola Tesla who was able to quiet his mind and describe the operation of a alternating current electrical generator at a time when there was no such thing. He could just conceive that, turn it over in his mind, mm-hmm. and the first one he built worked, and Westinghouse was in the AC electrical business, which is what allowed them to overtake Edison. So Tesla was a great visualizer. We don't know if he's a remote viewer. Now, a physicist is able to describe things that exist. So if you wanted me to describe some piece of laboratory apparatus in a distant place, I or some other physicist with remote viewing experience could describe that distant thing much better than a person who didn't know anything about physics.
Yes.
For example, I'm learning to do intuitive medical diagnosis that we can talk about later. And in order to do that, I watched 40 hours of anatomy and physiology videotapes so that if I scan somebody's body psychically,
I'll be
able to tell the difference between a gallbladder and a spleen.
You would know what you're seeing.
So that if I, right. So that a physicist has a much better chance. Joe McMonagle is very sophisticated about electronic hardware from his lifetime as an intelligence operative. So he can describe radar equipment and microwave equipment and mechanical stuff much better than, say, my dear photographer friend, Hella Hammond, who didn't know anything about technology.
Does remote viewing, Russell, eclipse time, the present, the future, the past? Does it matter? Can you look at the past as easily as you can what is happening presently and might happen in the future?
I would say that for listeners who are going to leave shortly, the most important thing I can tell you is that it's no harder to psychically describe the future than it is to describe the present. The reason that we know psychic abilities are non-local is that we can see into the distance and we can equally well see into the future. And that we can talk later about a trip I made to Russia where we had a famous Russian psychic describe what was going on in California 10,000 miles to the west and 2 hours into the future.
And the past, what about the past? Is that also accessible?
The past is a very tricky issue.
All right, hold it right there. We're going to break, and we'll be right back. My guest, Russell Targ. What he does is called remote viewing, and it's real. It is real, so it merits your attention. Stay right where you are.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, dark say good night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903.
It is, isn't it?
What a wonderful world.
Good evening, everybody. Russell Targ is here. He's a remote viewer, and finally, for the first time in, I guess, first time ever, certainly for me, we found out how remote viewing was born. And after hearing that, it's not hard to imagine why taxpayer dollars began flying into that program. Don't you agree? Once again, Russell Targ. Russell, I really would like to know, why is the past tricky?
Well, if you can describe something in the past, which I believe you can, you then have to get feedback to know if it's correct.
True.
For example, our good friend Stephen Schwartz has written a couple of books called The Secret Vaults of Time and The Alexander Project, where people would describe what it looks like under the desert. What did they have at Roman times buried in the desert? What were they doing there?
Mm-hmm.
And Hella described what they were doing there, and that you would find a circle of green stones if you dig here in the desert, and that's what they had in this ancient bathhouse 2,000 years ago. So she looked back in time and said there was a bathhouse here, and at that point it sounds like a correct view into the past. They then dug up the desert, and right where she marked it, they found a circle of green stones and what appeared to be a bathhouse. So, well, that looked like very good remote viewing into the past. But you could say that she was able to look instead into the future, and because I could have asked her the question, or Stephen Schwartz could have asked her the question, Hella, we're going to dig at this spot that you've identified.
Yes.
What does it look like after we dig this up? Can you look an hour or a week into the future?
So the past is tricky then, because it's difficult to verify that indeed that is what you're looking at. Is that it?
Exactly. It's hard to tell with any kind of look into the past that you're not actually precognitively describing what you will see at a later time in the future.
Well, you mentioned the name Nikola Tesla, and that set me to wondering. Obviously, the man had an incredible mind, and he probably knew things that would aid us today, for example, in our quest for energy that's quickly running out. And I don't know. You tell me, is it possible to examine instead of a thing? Can you examine, for example, a person who once lived?
That's it. You could try and make contact with him as a deceased person.
Oh?
That is, you're actually asking quite an interesting question. That is, could you go back in time and communicate with him at an earlier time?
Well, I don't know if that's what I'm asking. Maybe I'm asking what you just said. Maybe I'm saying, can you communicate with spirits? So I'm not sure which I'm asking, and the same verification problem, I guess, applies here, doesn't it? Would you be talking to the Nikola Tesla who once was in time, in a past time, is now passed on, or would you be finding the continuing living spirit, an intellect of Nikola Tesla, wherever he is now?
Well, I don't know. I'm pretty familiar with the research in this area, and I don't know of any experiments, maybe a listener will call in, I don't know of any experiments where a researcher tried to communicate with a person as that person was living at an earlier time. I just don't, I've never heard of that being done. That's a conceivable thing to try and do. Generally, they will say, well, this person is deceased, and there's been a lot of research in an effort to try and communicate with a person as a deceased entity. F.W. Myers, who was a great researcher at the turn of the century, had an idea that in order to communicate, in order to accurately determine whether or not a psychic medium was bringing you information from the deceased person rather than just manifesting some kind of super psychic ability, the deceased person would have to give fragmentary evidence messages to different mediums who weren't in touch with each other. And then if you had these fragmentary bits put together like a jigsaw puzzle, that would show that you really had a surviving spirit because you had all those little pieces, and ESP wouldn't do the trick. Myers then died in 1905 and posthumously carried out that experiment. So a scientist like myself is always very thrilled when somebody gets to think of an experiment while they're alive and then carry it on after they've died. And Myers was able, the posthumous Myers was able to send fragmentary information to several mediums. He sent them to Eleanor Piper in Boston, Lenore Piper in Boston, and to Mrs. Holland, who was the sister of Rudyard Kipling in India, and Mrs. Verrill in London. And this is the turn of the century, so there's no fast radio communication. And these mediums, who were not in communication with one another, got fragmentary images from messages from Myers. They then sent these Myers communication to the Society of Psychical Research in London,
yes,
where they were put together and assembled into meaningful messages of the type that Myers might send. But in a case where the pieces by themselves didn't make any sense, it's only when they were put together did they make sense. And these are called the cross-correspondence experiments. And it's one of the strongest kinds of evidence that the spirit of a person who has died actually survives. This is not reincarnation. This is evidence of survival of a deceased spirit.
Yes.
And the correspondence cases are considered very strong evidence that some aspect of us actually survives after a bodily death.
You believe that?
I think the evidence for that is quite good. As you may know, my daughter Elizabeth died a couple of years ago. She was a psychiatrist doing research in distant mental influence. And many people have received messages from her of a type like the Myers case, where people who didn't know Elizabeth but might have known of her,
yes,
had the feeling that Elizabeth was giving them a message and then shaking them by the shoulder and tapping them on the head, which is quite an unusual thing to have happened, very idiosyncratic thing. But a number of people have had this unusual experience, people who didn't know one another. So it's very good evidence that Elizabeth is still communicating with people. And my co-author, Jane Catra, is collecting information from a number of people who have spoken to her about messages that they've gotten from my deceased daughter. And I describe a number of things that have happened concerning Elizabeth. In my new book, Limitless Mind, I describe an adventure we had sitting on the porch talking about Elizabeth as the lights in the house flashed on and off. There was no one in the house, and each time we would mention her, the lights would flash on and off again. So you had a number of surprising occurrences that suggest that she's still here making an effort to communicate.
I'm in touch right now with a man, I believe, down in Florida named Tom, who is having a written word conversation. I may even get to him and interview him tomorrow night with what he calls a poltergeist, which is actually writing her name. In this case, the young lady's name is Sarah. And this is a man I believe. I may well have him on tomorrow night. He calls her a poltergeist, and who knows what she is, but her name is Sarah, and she is communicating with him in writing. Now, this is the kind of stuff, frankly, Russell, that a lot of people are just going to go, come on, you know, give me a break. This stuff doesn't happen, except it does, Russell. It does happen.
Well, as a physicist, of course, I'm most interested in things you can do in the laboratory. The physicists are always looking for evidence. What did you do? Why should I believe you're not making this up?
Yes.
But I agree with you. The evidence for survival, principally from the work of Ian Stevenson these days, where Stevenson has been writing about memories of children pertaining to their previous lives, where these children remember their previous wives and girlfriends and where they hid money and languages they used to speak. In some cases, they're able to remember who murdered them, so the perpetrator was actually arrested and put to prison.
Yes, but all of this seems so fragmentary and unrepeatable for the sake of science. It seems, on the one hand, so real and begs the question of why, of course, this is just an impossible question, Russell, but why we would have previous lives, why we would be incarnated again and again without benefit of experience, except in such a fragmentary, unreliable, wispy way. In other words, why not have full memory? It's an impossible question, so I don't expect you to answer.
Well, the memory is really attached to the physical body. The reason that we're interested in remote view, the reason I'm interested in remote viewing 30 years down the line, remote viewing, of course, can be used to find parking places and invest in the stock market. But more than that, its importance is to discover who you really are. That is, once you discover that you're able to expand your awareness in a true sense, mm-hmm, and experience what's happening beyond your physical body and move into the spaciousness of time and space, it becomes absolutely evident that you couldn't possibly be simply a physical body.
Well, many of the doubters out there, Russell, say exactly that. Well, okay, if a guy can remote view and if it's real, then yeah, how about it? Why has he not done well in the stock market? Why has he not used it for financial gain, picked the lottery numbers, I don't know, whatever?
Well, of course, we have done that, as you probably know. That is, in the 80s, we were working with an enthusiastic investor, and we're forecasting changes in the silver market. And each week for 9 weeks, we would forecast whether silver is going up a little, up a lot, down a little, down a lot. Mm-hmm. We were successful in all 9 of our forecasts and made about $120,000, which we split with the investor. That was investigated and wound up on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And Nova made a film about us called The Case of ESP. So there's no doubt that you can use psychic abilities. I should say
have you privately done so? I mean, once you've realized the ability to do that and demonstrated it, as you just suggested, gosh, for Nova, you would think that you would have then used it, I don't know, in other commodities markets and made money, or maybe you have.
Well, I would say that I use it when I ride my motorcycle. My vision is quite poor, as you may know. So I've been riding my motorcycle for more than 30 years, and I would say that my psychic ability is a day-to-day asset for me to to avoid being killed by a car.
Understandable, but again, have you actually used it for personal financial gain? And if you have not, why not?
Well, in writing my previous book, our publisher asked Jane Catra and me to demonstrate this remote viewing, because we were telling people in detail how to do remote viewing.
Yes.
And we were, Jane and I forecast silver futures with the help of two other people. And even your mild-mannered authors were successful in 11 out of 12 trials. And that's just the two of us recently. The probably hard-to-believe answer is that once you become very experienced at quieting your mind,
yes,
and residing in this flow of loving awareness that comes from the quiet mind, then using your quiet mind for forecasting silver futures seemed like an unattractive and boring thing to do.
No, I actually do understand that. I really do. But you're saying on the one hand it's possible, but on the other hand, the very nature of putting yourself into a sufficiently receptive state to do all of this takes you away from the material world.
Many people have used psychic abilities to make money. My colleague at SRI Hal Puthoff made several tens of thousands of dollars for a school. Stephen Schwartz at the Mobius program has made tens of thousands of dollars using remote viewing to forecast the stock market.
Yes.
So it is untrue that God won't let you use your ESP to make money. That is untrue. What generally happens is that when people learn to quiet their mind and be peaceful, they get in touch with their own loving core, and it becomes uninteresting, blasphemous in a certain sense. Not that you're going to be punished, but you can quiet your mind and experience the divine, feel the loving awareness, or make a forecast into the silver market, and silver becomes relatively uninteresting.
In the course of remote viewing, is there anywhere, Russell, or anything that occurs that makes one completely aware of the fact of a creator?
Now, I would say the fact of a creator is not part of either remote viewing or my personal ontology. That I think that we can experience the divine as participating in the love that's in the universe and the love that allows us to experience oneness with the universe and peace with the universe and a feeling of spaciousness and what the Buddhists call timeless awareness. So you become in contact with a universe filled with consciousness. But to say that there is a person who is a creator does not come out of that.
Mm-hmm, okay, that's.
There's no separation. That is, that we think it is not the case that there is a powerful God up there and a puny you down here, and you're struggling to get from down here to up there. That kind of dualistic approach creates suffering, and I think is an error. The divine that we want to communicate with is who we are. We are one with that divine, and that experience is available to anyone who learns to quiet his mind.
So, other than the obvious applications for, you know, for the government and spying, and
so you could say that I was a psychic spy for the CIA and found God. That I got to sit for 10 years in the dark, teaching people to be remote viewers, and as a result of sitting in the dark for 10 years and sharing these experiences, I began to get flashes of the divine, which is another aspect of this experience that's available.
Uh-huh. Is it an absolute truth that as the government or CIA would task remote viewers with going to find, you know, whatever, buildings, targets, defense facilities, that kind of thing, that simply getting themselves in this state of mind would tug them away from concentration on targets of that nature? Or was this the discipline involved in remote viewing for the CIA or military so strict that it kept somebody focused, and that did not occur?
Remote viewers are very disciplined. Remote viewing is a capability that is a mixture of your analytic paying attention and your surrender to the fragmentary images. So that if you ask me to describe a particular distant place, I have no problem doing that. The remote viewers are very disciplined, capable people who are able to describe distant things and future things and are not pulled away into the divine, if that's not what
they're trying to say. In other words, you can actually be disciplined to pass on by the divine for the nuts and bolts of the machine you're looking for. That was it. Hold on, Russell. We're at the top of the hour.
What do Mel Gibson and the...
He's got this dream about buying some land. He's gonna give up the booze and the one-night stands. And then he'll settle down in some quiet little town and forget about everything. But you know he'll always keep moving. You know he's never gonna stop moving.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Good morning. My guest is Russell Targ. He's a remote viewer, has been for our government, a lot of three-letter type government agencies and that sort of thing. Remote viewing is real. It's absolutely real. The question is, what are we going to do with it? And there's another question that I've wondered about for a long time. It involves famous, rich, successful people who are faced every single day with decisions in their life. I've wondered about this for the longest time, and I'm going to ask about it in a moment. Listen, if you want to email me, I'm artbell@aol.com or artbell@mindspring.com. That's artbell@mindspring.com. Now you've heard just a small part of how remote viewing got started, what Russell Targ does, a little bit of how he does it. I mean, here's something I've really always wondered about. I'm sure many of you have, haven't you? Rich people, people who have a lot of money, that made it themselves anyway. Successful people in their endeavor, whether it be corporate or with the media or, you know, famous people. People who have achieved in one arena or another, it really doesn't matter. They're like all other people. Perhaps with one exception. I mean, we are all faced with decisions in life. Life is nothing but one constant branch of decisions. Do I go to the right or do I go to the left? Do I do this or do I do that? It's all one decision after the other. And is it not possible that these rich, successful, well-known, whatever, that these people are simply, to a very lesser, less disciplined way, remote viewing, and basing the decisions they make in life on having quieted their mind and looking at these decisions in a considered way. And so, you know, I mean, you say, God, that Lucky is so lucky. Well, maybe he wasn't lucky. Maybe he was looking at what might be in each day, every time he had a decision to make, and making the right decision based on a sort of non-disciplined sort of remote viewing. You ever wonder about that, Russell?
Your consideration is exactly correct. You'll be happy to know. Douglas Dean, who is one of the great psychical researchers in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, whose big accomplishment was to get the Parapsychology Association into the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Douglas Dean asked the exact same question you're asking and answered it by going to a meeting of the young presidents of America. This is an annual banquet where you have 500 young presidents of corporations, and he gave all the presidents a simple ESP test with a punch board where they had to make 64 guesses as to whether it would be an odd number or an even number on their punch board. And what he found highly statistically significant results that the presidents of companies who were making money and growing showed significantly positive ESP. That is, they got significantly more correct answers than you would expect. And the presidents of companies that were failing and going out of business got significantly fewer correct answers than you would expect. That is to say, the guys who were going out of business used their ESP to determine the correct answer and would then do something different.
That's remarkable.
It was a published paper by Douglas Dean in the, 1965.
Well, that's
famous,
fascinating.
Famous experiment.
I expected an interesting opinion from you, but not a fact. And you hit me with
Douglas
a fact.
Douglas Dean published a book called Executive ESP.
Yes.
Talking about how it is that executives use their psychic ability in their work. And they can enhance their decision-making by whatever ESP comes their way. By the way, I'd like to give out my website because people are beginning to send me emails as I chat with you. My website is www.espresearch.com.
And what is at www.itis.right?
Yes.
ESPresearch.com.
What is there? A number of the papers that I've published describing the data for psychic research and how it works. I have a description of my new book, Limitless Mind, where I talk about stories that I've never told before. Sometime tonight we should talk about the search for Patricia Hearst that we were involved with.
All right.
Where we're helping the FBI look for the missing heiress.
All right.
But the website has a number of things about how remote viewing works and a way to communicate with me by email.
Russell, you look at these rich, successful, famous people, and you say, okay, fine, they're doing this au naturel. For the average person, they're probably sitting out there saying, well, is this a talent that I simply don't possess, or is it a talent that I can nurture and then use? Is it a talent that I can add to my repertoire of whatever now? Or is, if I'm not blessed already, am I doomed to be one of the lessers?
Well, the very good news is that remote viewing ability is something that people can, I was going to say they can learn. They already have the ability. That you don't have to, you have to practice it. You have to develop it and bring it out.
Well, what then, Russell, do you think is the difference between the executive that is successful and is just simply using it and not realizing it, and the person who is not using it and obviously doesn't realize it? isn't
the more
usable.
Successful an executive is, the more ESP he's using.
Got that, but I mean...
For example, if the executive is waiting for all the answers before he makes a decision, well, that's something that the mail clerk could do. If you give the mail clerk every answer, then he can make a decision. It's the executive who needs the least information who will be the most successful.
Well, I've got all that. What I guess I'm asking is, what's the difference between those who are unconsciously using this power or this ability and those who are not subconsciously using it or using it incorrectly?
The ones who are not using it are overcome with what we would call conditioned awareness, which is a source of suffering in addition to a source of diminishing your ESP. When your awareness is conditioned, everything you experience is governed and colored by your previous training, your previous experiences, the meaning you assign to things, what you learned in Sunday school, the past betrayals, injuries that you've experienced, so that everything you look at is colored by all of your past experience. The remote viewer is able to quiet his or her mind and experience the essence of the thing without memory or imagination or naming it. Ingo Swann was the one who told us about the problems of what he called analytical overlay, where you must learn to quiet your mind and describe directly what you're experiencing without the coloration and the naming that you want to do. For example, if I hold something up in my hand here and you say, I know what it is, it's a Swiss Army knife or it's a stapling machine, I would always tell the remote viewer, no, no, don't name it. I'm holding something very unusual here. If you can just describe what you're experiencing without naming it, then you have a chance of doing it.
Okay.
So the skill that people learn is to deal directly with their mental images without assigning a name or an attribution or coloring it with a memory or something from their imagination.
So right, well,
they have to learn to separate the psychic signal from the mental noise.
All right. Here's one for you, Russell.
And that can be taught.
Okay, so it can be taught. However, it just doesn't seem so controllable. From my own life experience, I pull the following. And any computer programmer, software programmer, or electronics technician, or person will be able to tell you that you're grappling with some sort of problem. You're thinking about it full time. I mean, you just really are cranking away, trying to figure out what the hell's wrong with this operating system, or what's wrong with this piece of electronic gear, and it will not come to you. And you've spent 2 days at it, and you're dead tired, and you go to sleep in disgust, I might add, self-loathing for not having figured it out, and then you wake up the next morning and you know the solution.
Well, intuition is a combination of your subconscious processes and what comes to you psychically.
But, I mean, is it the quieting of the mind that comes with sleep?
Oh, definitely. It's the stopping of the chatter, the quitting working on the problem makes it available. ESP doesn't get all the credit for that, gets some of the credit. But when you go to sleep on a problem, it allows your subconscious process to work on it and bring up all of what you've learned in a lifetime to work on the problem, in addition to whatever comes to you psychically.
Well, certainly going to sleep is a quieting of the conscious mind. No question about that, right?
Yes.
A quieting of the conscious mind. So... perhaps then, you know, without the clatter and the clutter of the conscious input, even if it's directed at a specific problem, suddenly the rest of your mind goes to work on it, or is quieted to the point that it receives the answer from this great library that seems to be out there. I don't know.
I think the library is out there, and since I left SRI, I've been traveling all over the world teaching people to do remote viewing. And the consequences of that is that I've seen startlingly good remote viewing from all sorts of people who had never done it before and are just blown away by their ability to do it.
All right, let us talk about the Patty Hearst case. And I had no idea that remote viewers were involved in any way in that, but what was done and how?
Well, when Patty Hearst was kidnapped, I believe in 1973 in California, it was a cause celeb because she was the daughter of the owner of the San Francisco Examiner, wealthy
yes.
San Francisco family.
Of course.
And the Berkeley Police Department came to us at Stanford Research Institute as a measure of how desperate they were and asked if they could, if we could help them find the missing heiress. And my colleague Hal Putoff and I, together with Pat Price, who's a very psychic retired police commissioner, Pat and Hal and I drove up to Berkeley to meet with the detectives. This is actually the first time I'm telling this story on the air.
Okay.
And they took us to the site of the kidnapping, and there were still cartridges rolling around under the bed so we could get a feeling of where this occurred. And when we finally got to the police station, they wanted to ask us questions, and Pat Price, who's a very confident, self-possessed, retired policeman himself, he said, none of that. Let me just see your mug book. Do you have a picture book of people who've been released from prison, the usual suspect book?
Mm.
And they pulled out a big dog-eared, brown-covered book that they laid on the oak table. And the three of us stood in front of this book as Price turned the pages, one page after another. Mm-hmm. Each page had four pictures on it. And by the time we got to page 10, Price put his finger on one of the men and said, that's the man, that's the leader. And he put his finger on a picture of Daniel DeVries, who we learned later was called Sin Q, who was in fact the leader of the SLA. Mm-hmm. And he told us, immediately, Price did, that this is not an ordinary kidnapping. This is a political kidnapping. These are terrorists. And nobody at that moment knew whether any of that was true, because we were just sitting in the police station. And he said, well, where did they go? And Price closed his eyes and pointed north and said, they went that way, up the highway. I see a white station wagon parked by two white gas storage tanks by an overpass next to a restaurant. And one of the policemen says, well, I know where that is. That's up by Vallejo. And as we sat in the station, the police station, they dispatched a car up in that direction, and they found the actual kidnapped car, abandoned car, right where Price saw it.
Wow.
And, of course, they had long since abandoned that car. And we were asked to participate in for several more days. And the great tragedy is that the Berkeley Police Department and the Sheriff's Department and the FBI would not cooperate. We provide bits of information to each of these people, but they wouldn't share information.
But after such a specific...
I should say, it's just like the 9/11 case, where the different law enforcement agencies wouldn't share information because they each wanted to have the prize of finding Patricia Hearst. If they had worked together, then they could have found her when she was still in San Francisco. So it was a tragedy that each of these people had their own little fiefdom and wouldn't share the information.
That's our government.
The following day, they had an idea that she was in the foothills of Santa Cruz. So I found myself in a police car with an officer driving up a hillside toward a little house, and he wanted to know if I knew how to handle firearms.
Mm.
And I said, yes, I own an automatic. He said, okay, take my service automatic here, not realizing he's driving with a legally blind researcher. So here's Mr. Magoo with an automatic in his hand, a policeman saying, cover my back as I break into the house.
Oh, now that might be a moment when you'd want to explain that part to him.
So I thought maybe this is outside my job description.
Yes.
They didn't train me this in graduate school at Columbia.
Yes.
So he, of course, did not find them there, and I gave him back his automatic, and we went back to Berkeley. But that was a memorable moment in the search for Patty Hearst.
Yes, I'll bet.
But we did get a letter of commendation. I mean, once again, there are people who say, well, Tarek's making it up. This never happened. We have a letter of commendation from the Berkeley Police Department thanking us for our contributions and the things that we did for them in this case, where we really provided the first indication to them what was going on, and Price, who is one of the greatest psychics we ever worked with, was able to put his finger on DeVries' picture and say, this is a man.
So, real psychic ability, rare it is, right? I mean, it really is at the Price level or some others we could mention. It is that level of ability.
Joe McMonagall, who's still alive today, is
yes.
functions at that level.
Yes, yes. So I've heard. But it's fairly rare, is it not? How much of a gap between somebody at home right now who could train themselves to some level of remote viewing and the kind of people we're talking about now, how much of a gap is there between...
Like a musical ability. I was surprised a few years ago. I'd always wanted to learn to play the piano. And a few years ago, after leaving Lockheed, I took piano lessons for half a year. And at the end of a half a year, I could actually play a little Mozart on the piano. And that greatly pleased me. But I'm never going to get to Carnegie Hall, but I actually could get someplace. And remote viewing is like that. We can show most people how to quiet their mind and describe an object hidden in a box or a picture hidden in an envelope.
How many Carnegie Hall quality remote viewers do you think are in America, Russell?
That's very hard. I really don't know. That I've probably, between the work that I've done and Ed May, who's another researcher, and a number, we've probably come across 20 people.
20.
In the course of our, but of course there are 100 million people that we didn't look at.
Yes.
So there are, we've encountered,
20 that you would put into that category.
Yeah, and I haven't met all of these. These people who that I just know by name.
Mm-hmm.
But in the course of my work, I mean, in teaching in Italy, every now and then I'll get somebody who will do a couple of startlingly accurate drawings. So I think that there are more people around than you would think.
I bet there are, and I bet a lot of them have the ability, know they have the ability, and have chosen consciously not to demonstrate it to a soul. Russell, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. I mean, after all, if you knew how to do these things, have these insights, would you tell the world? Would you go on tour? Would you join the circus? Well, the circus of paranormal investigators, maybe not. We'll be right back.
Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
A very good evening, everybody. If you'll go out and observe the night sky in the early evening, about an hour after the sun goes down, next couple of weeks, you'll see the planets lined up with an increasingly large ball that looks like a bowling ball ready to mow them down. It is a fascinating alignment of planets, best seen about an hour after the sun goes down or so. You know, we always get a list of sort of suggested questions that we can ask a guest. I rarely follow it, but there are a couple here that I find interesting. One is, do you have to believe in God to develop psychic abilities? Followed very quickly, and before you answer that, by, does that mean you think that psychic abilities are sacred or religious? That would imply to me that the answer is yes with respect to God or somewhere near it. What's the deal, Russell?
You don't have to believe anything to have psychic abilities.
Uh-huh.
You have to be able to quiet your mind. I was just trying to recall, somebody had just sent me an email on that question. That is, can you do science without belief? The science without belief is empty. And what we are not talking about belief at all. We're talking about an experience. Mystics are always inviting you to have a experience of some kind. That's how you can tell whether a person is a mystic or trying to push a particular dogma.
Right. The answer to that question is no, then. You don't have to believe in God to develop psychic abilities, right?
No, you do not have to believe anything. See, the mystics, whether they're Gnostic Christians, Buddhists, Hindus, Kabbalistic Jews, Sufis, will all tell you the same thing. They will say, if you will sit down and quiet your mind,
yes,
you will have the following type of experience. Try this practice as the Buddhists do. They give you a practice and say, come back in 3 weeks. Let us know what you experience. It's like a laboratory experiment.
Uh-huh.
Do this and tell me not what you experience. You don't have to believe anything. What you will discover is that you have the opportunity to experience spaciousness and this kind of timeless awareness that the mystics have talked about for many thousands of years. It's not about belief, it's about experience.
Hmm. Well, then what would have justified the following question, which I presume you generated? Does that mean you think that psychic abilities are sacred or religious? I mean, it would imply a yes to that
prior question. I don't think they're sacred or religious. I think psychic experiences are just experiences. They are a gateway to having religious experiences or mystic experiences or experiences of the transcendent.
Huh.
That is, by transcendent, I mean, once you learn to quiet your mind, whether it's for remote viewing or meditation,
yes,
or through music or with a transmitting teacher, once you learn to quiet your mind, your awareness will move into this transcendent region and you will begin to have these kind of spacious, timeless feelings where you discover that your awareness is not limited to your physical body. Now, I think that physical bodies are important, and the mystics tell us that physical bodies are hard to come by, so we should take good care of them. But it's not entirely who you are. Who you are is evidently this timeless awareness that is free to move through space and time. Physicist would say, you like to introduce me as a remote viewer. Actually, I'm a physicist investigating remote viewing and lasers and all kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
But from a physicist's point of view, we live in a non-local world. And more each day, the evidence for this non-local connection becomes an increasingly exciting part of modern physics. The fact that we live in a non-local universe is not a controversial idea. If I were a young physicist at Columbia, I would be studying the nature of our non-local universe. What it means for a remote viewer is that we're able to expand our awareness without limit through space and time and describe what's there, if that's what we want to do, or participate in this kind of unitive, loving, oceanic experience that occurs as you allow your awareness to merge with nature and become one with the divine.
In what way, Russell, does remote viewing, do you believe, have a connection to OBEs, out-of-body experiences? People certainly are able to have what they call out-of-body experiences. Is it similar?
Well, remote viewing is part of a continuum that goes from remote viewing. When we were working at Stanford Research Institute, we didn't want anybody to have a bad experience, so we or scare them. So we kept it very simple and asked them to describe what they see on their mental television. Just quiet your mind and describe what you're experiencing. But we knew, and our experienced remote viewers would be able to go well beyond that from remote viewing to an out-of-body experience. And in the out-of-body experience, you can take with you as much of your emotionality or sensitivity or sexuality or whatever you're comfortable with to have quite a involving experience at the destination point of your out-of-body experience.
Including a sexual experience, right?
That's what it appears, yes. But we didn't want people to come back to our management or back to the government and say, I took part in this experiment at Stanford and they separated my awareness from my body and I've been disintegrated. I can't get my body and my consciousness back together. Give me some money. We're eager to not have them. So we kept it simple.
Well, but
experienced remote viewers know that you can participate in a much more involving experience if you have the courage to do that.
Well, there are a bunch of guys, Russell, that listen to me in the joint, you know, because they don't have much better to do. They're there for years, if not their whole life. They would be particularly interested in this sexual aspect of remote viewing. Is it really actually connected to remote viewing or out of body or both? Is it all Jack London's story
called Star Rover, which he wrote when he was in prison about how a person is able to, let's see, I don't know that that's true. He wrote a story about a man who was in prison. Jack London may not have been in prison when he wrote this, but he wrote a famous book, Star Rover, about a man who was in prison and learned to deal with the terrible conditions of being imprisoned by quieting his mind and just moving out of the jail cell. It was a very detailed, probably 1920 version of remote viewing about how you can have all kind of adventures, see different things, travel around the world, and have experiences, including sexual experiences, with a distant person.
McKinley
Cantor wrote a book also called Don't Touch Me.
Would the distant person be aware of this invasion?
She certainly would. McKinley Cantor, who wrote Andersonville, Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, I knew Cantor, and he wrote a book called Don't Touch Me right after his service in the Korean War. And he would, there was supposedly a novel, but he would psychically come and visit his wife who lived in L.A. and have sex with her on the astral plane, if you will. And she didn't like that because it would occur when she was driving on the freeway or all sorts of inappropriate times. And this book, his book Don't Touch Me, describes her problems and his experiences of having a repeated psychic psychic sexual experiences with his wife during that whole period.
Russell, I wonder if there's ever been a survey of people imprisoned, and gosh knows we've got well over a million in this country now in prisons. Certainly they would be among the more desperate to escape their current surroundings and reality in favor of something of this sort. And so you would think their minds would be more likely forced into trying something like this than certainly the average population, for obvious reasons.
If I were in prison, I would not look to remote viewing for a sexual partner. I would rather look to remote viewing as a way of contacting the divine. The teaching and the experience of remote viewers and people who have found a peaceful place to reside,
yes,
is that they can experience this flow of loving awareness within themselves, which is what they're actually looking for. Which people look, it's like the popular song, looking for love in all the wrong places. What you can discover as you quiet your mind, it's sort of a gift of the remote viewing process. That is, you can make money in the stock market, find a parking place, or reside in this loving feeling, and you get to choose whether you're more interested in making money or being in love. But it's really not about finding a distant sexual partner. It's about the experiences of the divine and stopping your mind by having an opportunity to discover who you really are.
Yes, well, whether it would be sex or it would be an alternate reality really wouldn't matter. I mean, it would seem to me that a prisoner more than any other would be forced into a search for that kind of relief. And it might be interesting to do a survey of those who have been in prison and to see if they have found such.
Well, I certainly don't want to disparage sex or sound stupid about having a giving and receiving love with a sexual partner. If I were in prison, instead of focusing on sex, which is not available, I would focus on contacting the love that's available that does not require a distant partner, and that is available.
Well, other than your cellmate. Anyway, any alternate thing to prison is what I was referring to, not just the sex, but any alternate seeming reality, any way to escape, as it were, other than the physical variety.
There are spiritual teachers who visit prisons. And every now and then, somebody will receive a transmission, a loving encounter with a teacher, and wake up in prison, and then come out of prison and become a teacher.
Really?
So there are people who have that experience.
Now, you're beginning to apply what you have learned with the remote viewing to healing, haven't you?
The answer is no. But I'm very familiar with the healing research that goes on. I'm beginning to apply it. I'm not a healer. There's my co-author, Jane Catra, is a healer. I'm learning to do intuitive diagnosis, which is quite interesting to me, in that you can, after you learn some anatomy and physiology, it turns out surprisingly easy to be able to describe the physical condition of a distant person, and you can often describe that beyond what their doctors or the intermediaries know. And what surprises me about that is that it turns out to be easier to do this intuitive diagnosis, do a medical rundown of a distant person, turns out to be easier than ordinary remote viewing.
Now, are you doing this in what manner, so that we might understand? Are you visualizing the organs, for example, of a distant person and or a person even close by, it wouldn't matter, I suppose, and seeing something dysfunctional about those organs? Is in what way is do you become
Some
aware?
People give me a card containing, generally I'll ask them to give me a bunch of cards and I'll choose one, so the person who's given me the card doesn't know the answer. Because I was eager when I was learning to do this, I did not want to simply learn to read the mind of the person who's giving me a card.
Oh, yes.
So I would be holding a card in my hand, and nobody in the world knew what was on that card, on that particular card. And I would then visualize a person associated with that card. In the vocabulary of the remote viewing, I would say, I have a person who needs a description, which is how we'd always initiate our remote viewing. And a person would then appear to me on my mental screen, and I would visually simply run down their body from top to bottom.
Uh-huh.
The other people who do this, I should say, Judith Orloff, who's a psychiatrist, and Mona Lisa Schultz, both of whom have written books about intuitive diagnosis, believe the chakra model is helpful and they go from the bottom up. But be that as it may, I visualize starting at their head, visualize their body and their organs, their musculature and their skeleton, and the parts that have a problem light up for me, and I can describe what I'm seeing, what appears to be the matter. And together with my knowledge of anatomy and physiology, I can sometimes say directly, what's lit up here is a pancreas, and it looks like a kind of disgusting orange instead of its nice pink nature. I think this person is diabetic. And I've been surprisingly correct.
Russell, what do you think is lighting up these organs?
I have no idea. What it means is that I have some kind of resonance or connection with the distant person. The model that I have is from my many hours of looking at anatomy and physiology tapes. So I now have in my head quite a good picture set
of what ought to be
of organs.
Yes, of what ought to be. But that's the key question, of course.
But in one case, I saw that somebody had kind of a bright electrical sparking thing on her left shoulder, and nobody knew anything about it. And it turned out with investigation, she had been a professional tennis player, had a shoulder separation, and indeed there was a metal plate in her left shoulder. Nobody at all knew about it. So it was the only way I could have gotten that impression was some kind of direct psychic connection with this person who's all I had was their name in an envelope.
When these things occur, Russell, do you attempt to immediately document them, get documents saying, Russell Targ had no prior knowledge of my condition, here is the way it happened, here's what he said, in other words, to continually document all of this?
Well, I did that when I was working with a medical intuitive who I was working with a medical intuitive who knew I was doing remote viewing. And she said, you might like to try and do this intuitive work as I do. And it turned out that because I took the trouble to really learn anatomy and physiology, and I was an experienced remote viewer, I gave much more analytical descriptions than she did, even as a professional. Because as a remote viewer, I'm used to working for the government. And if you don't give details, they'll say this is a lot of nonsense. So I was giving very detailed descriptions. We always had the idea that in order to be right, you have to be willing to be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I would give much more detailed physiological and anatomical descriptions than the ordinary intuitive diagnosis, because I don't have a shingle out as a medical intuitive. And what surprised the hell out of me is how very accurate you can be in doing this kind of remote viewing.
Russell, an honest answer. How often are you wrong?
In the intuitive diagnosis, I am very rarely wrong. It's an anomaly. In remote viewing, I might be right half the time describing an object in a box or in a good series two-thirds of the time. In the intuitive diagnosis, the people who do that I've talked with, Judith Orloff, who's probably been on your show, she's a medical intuitive and a psychiatrist.
Yes.
And an experienced remote viewer, and she and I sort of shook our heads in agreement that for reasons we don't understand, the intuitive diagnosis is a lot easier than remote viewing, and more reliable, and more accurate. And it's probably because it's more meaningful for me to try and describe the condition of a distant person than to describe the object in the box.
All right. Russell, hold tight when we get back. Yes, we will, in this next hour, begin going to the phone. So if you have questions for Russell Targ, what a fascinating night. We're going to be going to that shortly. I'm Art Bell from the high desert in the middle of the night. This is Coast to Coast AM.
What do Mel Gibson and the court...
Take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
You know, I've got a couple of really obvious questions for Russell Targ. Might as well give him warning right now. What do you think? I mean, everybody fast blasts or emails this. If these guys can really remote view, if they can really look at distant objects and or people and locate them like Patty Hearst, then what about Osama bin Laden? What about 9-1-1? That if events in history, if future history, how's that, future history, stand out like a sore thumb, then surely the airplanes that were driven into the buildings in New York had to have been out there like a big sore thumb. So what happened? How come they didn't find out about that? In a moment, we will ask. Kind of a matter of etiquette of hosting a show. You know, I have a very well-qualified guest of this sort, Russell Targ, and you want him to be able to plug his book a little bit. It's Limitless Mind. I mean, if you've been listening to all of this and you're intrigued and you believe it to be true, and by the way, I do. I certainly do. And you want to know more and perhaps apply it in your life, then this is the kind of research you'd want to do. The book is Limitless Mind, A Guide to Remote Viewing and Transformation of Consciousness. The website is www.espresearch.com. That's very easy. espresearch.com. All right, Russell, welcome back. The obvious question, and you know, whenever a remote viewer is on, always 911, why didn't they know? Osama bin Laden. Everybody's looking for him. It seems like an obvious target. So, I don't know, one at a time, 911. If the future is possible to look at, surely that one must have been sticking up there like the World Trade Centers.
Well, we had a program at Stanford Research Institute that was working for all the intelligence communities through 1995, where we had a whole team of remote viewers who were providing information to the U.S. government intelligence community. And by 1995, the Berlin Wall was down, the Russians didn't seem to be a hazard,
right,
and the intelligence community in their wisdom decided America no longer had any enemies, so they disbanded the remote viewing program. and that was really the end of organized, government-supported remote viewing in America.
But had it been effective to their satisfaction, surely once we did discover we had enemies again, then you should be back.
I think they're probably freelance people from the Army program, from the remote viewing program, who are working for the intelligence community. I would guess that. And I wouldn't be surprised if there was some secret remote viewing program in the basement of the Pentagon about which I have no knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with regard to 911 sticking up like a sore thumb,
yes, sir.
The work that Dean Radin is doing at the Institute of Noetic Sciences gave evidence for that kind of thing, where he looks at the output of random number generators all over the world. And these combined random number generators get coherent when there is some kind of worldwide tragedy or event or something occurring.
Yes.
And 2 hours before the 9/11 calamity, there was a big spike in worldwide random number generator coherence.
I'm very well aware of that.
Now, why it was beforehand, we don't know. But there certainly was a significant blip in the worldwide machine coherence before the event actually occurred.
Yes, and again, I'm aware of that. So are you suggesting then that remote viewers like yourself simply weren't looking?
That's right. It's very hard to see something that you're not looking at.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the random number generators, the strongest case is when the random number generators were all tuned up just before the O.J. Simpson case was examined and then revealed to the worldwide press waiting. Tens of millions of people glued to their television. Everybody's paying attention, and then they tore open the envelope and announced that he was judged innocent. That was the biggest statistical event on the random number generator that occurred right at the instant, and I believe that it's because everybody was queued up and you had a tremendous release of effort and release of attention
mm-hmm.
on that exact moment. It's
mm-hmm.
not like an earthquake that occurs over the period of many minutes or hours, or 9/11, which was spread out over a half a day. For certain things, where there is a unique instant when it occurs, then you have a uniquely large signal from these worldwide random number generators.
Oh, some
with
of them are.
To been finding a hidden person.
Yes.
It depends where he's hidden. When we were searching for Patricia Hearst, we were quite willing to find out what street corner in L.A. she was hidden at and try and get house numbers and try and describe a building, and that was a sensible task for remote viewing. On the other hand, you can close your eyes and say that Bin Laden is in a cave, there's an oriental carpet on the floor, there's several kerosene burners spread out around him, the group of people standing there with automatic weapons, and that's probably entirely correct, but that doesn't tell you where the cave is. Remote viewing is not generally a kind of dowsing procedure, so you can describe what it looks like where a person is, but unless you have some other coordinates or unique geography, then it's very hard to find out exactly where he is.
Do you believe, Russell, that remote influencing is possible?
Well, the evidence for distant mental influence with regard to healing is very well documented. As you know, my daughter Elizabeth was a psychiatrist and conducted early experiments about 4 years ago, where she was working with 60 AIDS patients in San Francisco, and she had people all over the country praying for her AIDS patients.
Mm-hmm.
They were divided in two groups. 30 were in the prayed for group, and their pictures were sent out to healers of various persuasions. These would be Native Americans, Reiki healers, Barbara Brennan, energy healers, spiritual healers of various types, and the 30 men for whom prayers were said had very much better outcomes than the people for whom no prayers were said. The men receiving prayers had fewer trips to the hospital, fewer opportunistic illnesses, fewer days in the hospital.
I am very familiar.
Published in the Western Medical Journal.
Very familiar with the studies, and I believe it. But if it's possibly, if you can possibly influence in a positive way, either in diagnosis or in healing, then it seems to me that the only difference between that and harming somebody is intent. Would you think that would be
true? I think that's true. I think that if I can send you, I mean, you can just think about the experiment. I can close my eyes and ask you to describe what I'm thinking about. You say, it looks to me like an ice cream cone. I say, that's exactly right. I was able to telepathically, you got that, right? I was able to send you telepathically an ice cream cone in the middle of the night. So you were able to experience my psychic ice cream cone. Now, presumably, a person could send you some frightening or disturbing picture just as well. And if you were open to receiving that, then you would be very vulnerable. If you weren't open to receiving that, it would be less so. Deanne Fortune in the 30s wrote a book called Psychic Self-Defense, where she talked about how to protect yourself and build walls of light and good mental health. But it's obvious that if you can send a healing intention, a kind of healing template to help somebody improve their health, then you could send them something to at least confuse them or interfere with their mental functioning.
Okay. To the phones. First time caller line, you're on the air with Russell Targ. Hi.
Hello, how you doing?
All right.
This is Barry from Los Angeles.
Yes, Barry.
Hey, I would like to ask a question. At first, I'd like to say that I've been a student of healing for the last year and a half, and we do some of the very same techniques that Russell is explaining. However, we're trying to go down to a cellular level, to the DNA, and same thing pretty much happens sometimes. You know, I can get in and I can see, you know, the rungs of the DNA and, you know, which ones, you know, are not lighting up properly. And but the thing that Russell touched on that I want to ask the question is that what is the best way to quiet the mind? Because sometimes I'm in, you know, I can lock in, and sometimes I feel like, you know, my signal's multiplexed and I get all this crosstalk. And
that's a really, really good question. Russell, right. There are nights I can lie in bed, and no matter what I do, I cannot quiet my mind, and therefore I cannot sleep. So even applied to that simple problem, or not so simple problem, Russell, how does one best quiet their mind?
Well, the millennial, for a thousand of years, the Buddhists have taught that the best way to quiet your mind is to focus your attention on your breathing. And some form of that is certainly the thing that works best for most people, where you sit down, give up worrying about your daily mental residue, your things that you're concerned about for the next day, your anxiety and wish fulfillment and so forth.
All this
and focus on your breath going in and out.
Oh.
Now, in teaching people to do remote viewing, we're aware that the tried and true tradition is to focus on your breathing, but in the remote viewing lessons, we don't do anything of the sort. And the remote viewers that I worked with don't. So it's really in order to get started.
Well, what do they do?
The remote viewers simply take a couple of deep breaths or a few deep breaths, focus their attention on what they're trying to do next.
I see.
And I have this magic shibboleth instruction that we have an object or we have a person or a place that needs a description. And actually, as you know, there are a variety of people, some who appear on your show charge thousands of dollars to learn how to do remote viewing.
Yes.
In my new little book, Limitless Mind, we tell people in a couple of chapters how to find a friend and practice remote viewing with that friend And using the procedures we've learned at SRI, you can learn to do remote viewing surprisingly well apart from going into a detailed meditation program. So although we emphasize learning to separate the psychic signal and the mental noise, getting rid of that noise and getting rid of the conditioned awareness and the naming and grasping is what we emphasize rather than techniques to get the quiet mind. It's very, very hard to get a quiet mind because something will always come in. And what we focus on is having the psychic signal coming in rather than just holding the quiet mind. That is, when you have a quiet mind, when you're meditating, there will continually be things that pop in, and then you just let them go, and they pop in, and you let them go. In teaching remote viewing, you encourage people to focus on the target you're trying to describe, and then fragments of that target will pop in, and you describe those, rather than just experiencing the void and empty space.
Fascinating. All right.
The short answer to your question is we teach people to focus on the answer rather than trying to focus on emptiness. Mm-hmm. Emptiness is really tough.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Russell Tarr. Good morning.
Hi, Art. This is Mike just outside Toledo, 1370 WSPD.
Hey, Mike.
Two quick ones. There's been a longstanding debate in philosophy mostly about whether reality is objective or subjective. I'm wondering what the remote viewer's take on that would be from your experience.
Okay.
Number two.
Russell?
The remote viewers would say that you give all the meaning to your experience that there is. That is, reality has certain elemental aspects, but beyond, and that's what the remote viewer wants to describe. Beyond that, there's all the problems of your conditioned awareness, where you tend to name things and describe it from your past experience, your past suffering, your past teaching. So I could say that's why adults are better remote viewers than children. Children may be more psychic, but adults have the vocabulary and the discipline and skill to be able to say, I'm looking at something that looks like a cylinder, there's a line halfway up, and
sure,
it looks blue, rather than saying, glass of water.
Yeah.
So the objective reality is a complicated issue for the remote viewer, because the remote viewer wants to deal with the very simplest aspects of reality and avoid the meaning.
Does that feel like your question got answered?
Absolutely. It sounds like there's a mesh of the two. Like, you want to use objective reality, but subjective is the experience is what's important.
Right.
The second question was, very simply, is it possible to target a human soul? And if so, can you tell the character of that soul? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
All right. Can you target a human soul?
I'm not actually sure what a soul is. I'm not sure. You can...
Let's change word.
What does that mean to you?
Can you target an individual consciousness, Russell?
Sometimes what a person's intentions are.
Yes.
You can focus on their health. You can often be in contact with a person who's deceased and communicate with their spirit or the residual awareness that the aspect that survived.
Huh.
So you can learn a surprising amount about persons living and dead through opening yourself up to these kind of experiences.
So to answer, you can target a consciousness.
Well, I'm not. I probably like to let that go because I don't have a good sense of what he means. You can tell what a person is thinking and what they're feeling and what their intentions are. And I think that's pretty close to their consciousness.
Yeah, I would too. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Russell Targ. Hello.
Do the wild thing at 775-727-1295.
We don't allow last names on the show, so I'm going to bleep that out and we're going to start fresh. Your name is Richard, right?
Yes.
And
okay. If you had talked earlier in the show about being able to remote view into someone, and there's been cases of persons that have gone and had sexual conduct or experience with their spouses or other person. And my question is this, would it be safe to assume that there's been purported cases of persons that have been assaulted by entities? Would it be safe to assume that maybe it was other persons that were remote viewing into these women? Are you familiar with those cases? I think you are, Mr. Bell.
Well, I'm not in detail. I'm familiar with the idea. That is, there's certainly a big literature on psychic sexuality. In fact, the great remote viewer Ingo Swann has published a book called Psychic Sexuality, which would be the place to start. And as I mentioned earlier, McKinley Cantor has a book called Don't Touch Me, and there's a whole literature of people who have sexual encounter with distant other living people. So it's not really entities, but one person can have a encounter
with another.
The literature is about sex on the astral plane. Aleister Crowley writes about this. So that's a subject that's been of great interest for a lot of years.
All right,
the answer to the caller's question is probably yes.
All right, hold it right there.
Nights in white satin, never reaching the end. Letters I've written, never meaning to send. Beauty I'd always miss with these eyes.
Talk with Art Bell. Call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Who loves you, baby? Well, with remote viewing, maybe anybody at any distance. There you are on the interstate, and there's that little tickle again. Oh, boy, only in the nighttime. It's pretty interesting, actually, that a number of the out-of-body experiencers and teachers that I've had on the program, as well as a number of remote viewers, a large number, have always mentioned this sexual aspect to it all. So I'm beginning to get the idea that it's a bigger aspect than you might. In other words, it's hard to talk about, but it's being repeated by so many people like yourself, Russell, that there must be quite a bit to it for you to go out of your way to mention it like this.
I need to go out of my way to not mention it, actually.
Well, that's what I mean, that most would do that, and that's leading me to believe it really is a larger aspect to this.
Bob Monroe, in his Journeys Out of the Body, has a chapter or two discussing his sexual encounters with the woman he actually married. Yeah. They met on the astral plane. He describes in some detail pinching her and then the sexual encounter. Aleister Crowley's whole book on ritual magic talks about sex in the astral plane, got him into a lot of trouble. Ingo Swann has an excellent book called Psychic Sexuality. So a lot of people are writing about what it pertains to.
And so it is a big aspect.
And in the occult literature, the idea of sex on the astral plane is a common occurrence. It is everybody writes about it, everybody knows about it. It's not part of ordinary remote viewing, where we're like Lieutenant Friday. We're just trying to get the data. We're trying to describe and experience what's happening in a distant place with ordinary reality. But certainly there's a continuum from remote viewing to out-of-body experience where you can bring with you emotionality, sexuality, sensitivity, if you are prepared for a possible scary experience.
Well,
because once you surrender all your emotionality to being in a location away from your body, then your little apple cart can be upset while you're away from your body, and you can scare yourself.
Okay, well, but how about this, Russell? If this is real, I mean, if the remote viewing OBE aspect and the sexual aspect of this is true, and the people who experience or the recipients of this visit, for lack of a better word, if they're aware of it, then why isn't it, it's like rape? And if it
well,
isn't...
in my limited experience, this connection works between consenting adults who know somebody, who know one another.
Oh!
I don't think you can just pop in on some unsuspecting person with you, whom you have no contact.
Well, okay. The situation you described, of course, was a wife, but I mean the husband was not aware that she was on the freeway, or he might have refrained, right? In other words, she wouldn't necessarily welcome it at that time on the freeway there, naturally.
That is the only first-hand reports or experience I've had in this direction is with, has always been between people who know one another.
Gotcha.
Well.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Well, maybe
I don't think you can psychically pop in on a movie star and have psychic sex with him or her.
Well, that's a good thing. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Russell Targ. Hello.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
All right, sir.
Love the show.
Thank you.
Just had a quick question for the guy. I wanted to find out, this is more along the line of physics and, you know, what our capabilities are and our, as far as security these days. My question is relative to, container inspection and, radiation detection and things along those lines. I wanted to ask, for instance, the way that we're, you know, having our ships come in these days and brought into the ports with our limited agents to do inspections on those containers and things.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask the gentleman if he could tell me whether or not we have a capability of sort of maybe changing the way that that our ports are, you know, are serviced, maybe reorganizing our shipping lanes in sort of a an air traffic control type environment to where we're directing ships through specific areas and lanes of travel that then could be met at sea, possibly, you know, 1 to 2 miles out, whatever a safe radius would be.
Right. All right. Let me go ahead and carry on for you. He obviously wants enhanced security for the shipping to the United States, which is done in these very large containers, as you know, Russell. And so maybe you could answer from a two points of view here. One, as a physicist, you could tell us what is the state of the art in detection of things like, oh, I don't know, dirty bombs.
I can tell you easier from the point of view of a remote viewer.
And that was going to be second.
That is, it would be very, from a physics point of view, it would be very hard to tell whether somebody is shipping in 2 kilograms of plutonium in a lead-lined box.
Okay.
Using ordinary radiation detectors. On the other hand, a experienced remote viewer who's hired to scan cargo containers could just scan the cargo containers on the dock and say, I'd have a look at that one. That one looks like it has a problem. He may not know that it's a radiation source, but we've done experiments like that where we had said which of 10 filing cabinets contains a simulated bomb, or in this case with a revolver, or which box contains the
and with what kind of
missile.
What kind of hit rate?
See, we did this sometime. The one we did with the MX missile, we were right on the money a couple of times, and that we may have actually played a part in killing the MX missile program, because we were able to tell which of 10 silos the simulated missile was hiding in. Remote viewers in a case like that can be right two-thirds of the time.
Well,
I wouldn't want to bet my life on one occurrence, but you can definitely increase your likelihood greatly that you'll be able to scan the ship and tell if there's something hidden in it.
What is the likelihood that our government will begin to use the services of people like that for that purpose?
Pretty unlikely, because we don't know how it works. Until either the reliability gets higher,
mm-hmm.
or we begin to have a better physical theory for how this works, I don't see the government getting involved in this particular application.
Okay. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Russell Targ. Hello.
Talking to me?
I am.
Yeah. This is Ed in Petaluma.
Hello, Ed.
I have two quick questions. First of all, does this remote viewing have a range limit?
Remote viewing has absolutely no range. It's a non-local ability. You're able to describe and experience things across the street or off the planet. There's no range limitation, and the important part of that is that in any non-local phenomena, going to further distance does not make it harder. It's just as easy to describe something in Russia as it is in Nevada, across the town.
Again, my second question would be, is there like any places on Earth or anywhere else that you've never been able to remote view? Like something would cause it, not blocks it?
I'm not aware of places that we can't look. We've been very successful. We've been asked to look at atomic bomb tests in China, look in on the hostages in Iran, weapons factories in Russia. We saw a lost airplane in Africa, been looked into National Security Agency in Virginia, been able to look into all sorts of classified secret locations. And Pat Price used to say, the more you hide something, the greater it shines in psychic space.
Also, what about non-human intelligence, Russell? Has there been any detection? We have these UFO things flying around our skies. I wonder if there's been any work in that area at all, in ufology, whether or not there's actually a non-human intelligence flitting about the planet.
Well, remote viewers have had experiences with UFOs, but it's very hard to verify them, isn't it? So that if Pat Price tells you or I tell you that I've been on a UFO and I saw this and that, well, that makes an interesting story, and you can believe I'm not lying to you, but you don't know if I'm making it up or it's a hallucination. So the fact that I visited a UFO or Price visited a UFO...
No way to verify.
No, and what's interesting is we might have seen the same thing.
All right. Having said all that, Russell, have you detected what you believe to be non-human intelligence on the planet?
No, I have not had. I've not had that kind of experience.
Okay, you know of others that have.
Well, Price felt it. Pat Price felt that he had.
Well, after what you've told me about Pat Price, then that impresses me.
Yeah, it would impress me also. We were not pursuing that. We were good soldiers doing what the government told us to do. Off hours, we might talk about that kind of thing. But we had not, No aliens came to interfere with our remote viewing.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Russell Targ. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Jerry from Orlando.
Hi, Jerry.
I was wondering if Russell can intuit healing and can see into the future remote viewing, why couldn't he go and see what his daughter had?
Okay,
let me figure a way to heal it.
Let me correct you. I think he cannot intuit healing himself. I believe he said he can diagnose, but that others can heal.
Okay, then if he could diagnose it, why couldn't he go, say, 30 years in the future and find a cure for it?
Russell?
Well, his daughter.
People may be working on that. My daughter was quite sick by the time we discovered that she was sick, and we did the best we could for her, and medical science at that time was not very helpful at all, sorry to say. But I think the idea of looking, your idea is not bad. The idea of looking into the future to discover the cure of an illness
yes.
is a worthwhile thing to do. And maybe a smart doctor like my daughter, now that she has a greater source of information having died, maybe she'll give us some added information.
Russell.
As long as she's in contact with us.
Russell, if you were to look 30 years, let's say, into the future and discover a cure for colon cancer, wouldn't that violate something? In other words, if we began on the basis of your intuitive revelation to cure colon cancer now, people would be alive who shouldn't be alive. And when it did get up to the moment of discovery, whoever discovered it would have been cheated by 30 years out of his discovery. I mean, somewhere along the line, it sounds like there's some sort of violation of something
to do with time travel. we can take something simple like forecasting changes in the silver market.
Yes.
Now, we were able to ask someone to describe what we were going to show them at a later time, describe an object that corresponds to whether the market is going up or the object corresponding to the market going down, where the object they get to see is governed by whether the market went up or down.
Mm.
They were able to do that very, very successfully. So this is a case where the future is affecting the past. The future is giving you information at an earlier time that you can use.
Yes.
There's no doubt that that occurs. There's one of the interesting things about remote viewing is that it's no harder to look into the future than it is to look into the present. So that says that the future is affecting the present. So the future can affect the present with regard to the change in the silver markets or a cure for cancer. So I have no doubt. I mean, of the questions you've asked me, I'm often doubtful about whether you can do this or that. But I'm certain that you can get information from the future.
Well, I guess I was just asking if there weren't some sort of cosmic consequences to something that big.
Well, I think that we don't understand causality. That is, we probably know more about remote viewing than we know about causality, and that may surprise a lot of people. That is, remote viewing is extremely well documented.
Indeed.
We can teach people how to do it. How it is that information is available from the future is more of a puzzle than the fact that it is available.
Yeah.
So I have no doubt that it's available.
No problem with saying, I don't know. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Russell Targ. Hi.
Good evening, Russell, Arg. It's a pleasure. Two quick questions. One was with the healing. Is there a way to tap into a group of people who do that? And then
with
since
the group of
In other words, she's probably got a relative who's ill, and she's interested in getting somebody healed or having a prayer group or whatever, something like that.
Or be on it.
Mm. I would say for information, you can call the Institute for Noetic Sciences in Petaluma.
Institute for?
N-O-E-T-I-C.
Noetic Sciences.
Although, Art, you just mentioned about the ethics. Maybe it isn't ethical to heal people before their time. I don't know.
It's always ethical to pray for somebody's health.
Got a point. My second very quick question, when you mentioned about the ice cream cone and passing that image, or it could be a negative image, it made me think, is this the principle on which supposed voodoo and curses would be enacted, or is that something that would also have to have both parties permission as the sexual exchange did?
That's actually not known. That's a good question. In the voodoo hexing, generally the person who is the victim of the hex also believes that that will be very deleterious to him.
Yes.
So that's an astute question, and I think to damage a person greatly, in a certain sense, requires their cooperation.
That's kind of nice to hear in a way, since I don't want to believe in those things. Then maybe I'm safe. But, yeah, very interesting. Wonderful show, you guys. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much. Your book, again, is Limitless Mind, A Guide to Remote Viewing and Transformation of Consciousness. Now, that's available, Russell.
Available at bookstores everywhere and at Amazon.com. And we teach people in detail how to do remote viewing in Limitless Mind.
How long has this book been out?
The book has been out since January.
January.
It's a new book.
Still a baby. And your website, www.espresearch.com, is, I guess, a little taste of, in other words, that's a good free way to get a look at all or some more of this before you would move on.
Data on remote viewing, description of the book, and theories about how ESP works. A lot of information.
Do you think, as a final quick question, because we're about out of time here, that ESP and science, at what point do you see them coming together in a very concrete way? 10, 20 years into the future, where in our future will science and, I guess, ESP or...
Well, I think that there is no conflict between ESP and science. ESP is just a body of science that I consider myself a scientist, collecting data, publishing papers. We don't understand entirely how ESP works, so we have some pretty good ideas that we can talk about another day about how to make a rapprochement between psychic abilities and our understanding of the non-local world that we live in.
That's perfect.
Maybe we can get together on your show with Michio Kaku someday and talk about ESP and science.
Yes, you really want to do that, don't you?
Well, I think that would be fun because we have a lot of data, and the evidence for psychic ability is very strong, and he thinks that there is no such thing. So
yeah,
that's
a good idea. Let me go to work on that, Russell. In the meantime, we're out of time. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Good night. Russell Targ, again, his book, Limitless Mind, A Guide to Remote Viewing and Transformation of Consciousness. Well, folks, listen, that's it for tonight. Tomorrow night, anything goes. By the way, suggestions welcome, artbell@mindspring.com or artbell@aol.com.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born.